She said she was from Cambridge, said Walter blankly.
Not that Cambridge. My Cambridge is in Massachusetts.
My voice creaked from stress and disuse. I cleared my throat. The colony will exist north of Roanoke in another 40 years. A din of exclamations rose, and questions came at me from all directions. Harriet reached over and hesitantly touched my shoulder. When his finger met solid flesh, he withdrew it in wonder.
I have heard about creatures who could bend time to their will. This is a marvelous day, is it not, Kit? Did you ever think to know a time spinner? We must be careful around her, of course, or we might get entangled in her web and lose our way.
Harriet's face was wistful, as if he might enjoy being caught up in another world.
And what brings you here, Mistress Royden?
Walter's deep voice cut through the chatter.
Diana's father was a scholar, Matthew replied for me.
There were murmurs of interest, quelled by Walter's upraised hand.
Her mother, too. Both were witches and died under mysterious circumstances.
That is something we share, then, Diana, Henry said with a shudder.
Before I could ask the Earl what he meant, Walter waved Matthew on.
As a result, her education as a witch was overlooked, Matthew continued.
It is easy to prey on such a witch.
Tom frowned.
Why, in this new world to come, is more care not taken with such a creature?
My magic and my family's long history with it meant nothing to me. You must understand what it's like to want to go beyond the restrictions of your birth.
I looked at Kit, the shoemaker's son, hoping for agreement, if not sympathy, but he turned away.
Ignorance is an unforgivable sin.
Kit fussed with a bit of red silk that was peeking out of one of the dozens of jagged slashes cut into his black doublet.
So is disloyalty, said Walter. Go on, Matthew.
Diana may not have trained in the craft of a witch, but she is far from ignorant. She is a scholar, too, Matthew said proudly, with a passion for alchemy.
Lady alchemists are nothing but kitchen philosophers, Kit sniffed. More interested in improving their complexions than understanding the secrets of nature.
I study alchemy in the library, not the kitchen, I snapped, forgetting to modulate my tone or accent. Kit's eyes widened. Then I teach students about the subject at a university.
They will let women teach at the university?
George said, fascinated and repelled in equal measure.
Matriculate, too, Matthew murmured, pulling on the tip of his nose apologetically. Diana went to Oxford.
That must have improved attendance at lectures, Walter commented dryly. Had women been allowed at Oriel, even I might have taken another degree. And are lady scholars under attack in this future colony somewhere north of Roanoke?
It was a reasonable conclusion to have drawn from Matthew's story thus far.
Not all of them, no. But Diana found a lost book at the university.
The members of the School of Night pitched forward in their seats. Lost books were of far more interest to this group than were ignorant witches and lady scholars.
It contains secret information about the world of creatures.
The Book of Mysteries that is supposed to tell of our creation?
Kit looked amazed.
You've never been interested in those fables before, Matthew. In fact, you've dismissed them as superstition.
I believe in them now, Kit. Diana's discovery brought enemies to her door.
And you were with her. So her enemies lifted the latch and entered.
Walter shook his head.
Why did Matthew's regard affect such dire consequences? George asked.
His finger searched out the black gross-grain ribbon that tied his spectacles to the fastenings on his doublet. The doublet was fashionably puffed out over his stomach, and the stuffing rustled like a bag of oatmeal whenever he moved. George lifted the round frames to his face and examined me as if I were an interesting new object of study.
Because witches and huerchs are forbidden to marry, Kit said promptly.
I'd never heard the word huech before, with its whistling W at the beginning and guttural sound at the end.
So are demons and huechs.
Walter clamped a warning hand on Kit's shoulder.
Really?
George blinked at Matthew, then at me.
Does the Queen forbid such a match?
It is an ancient covenant between creatures that none dares to disobey. Tom sounded frightened.
Those who do so are called to account by the congregation and punished.
Only vampires as old as Matthew could remember a time before the covenant had established how creatures were to behave with one another and interact with the humans who surrounded us. No fraternizing between otherworldly species was the most important rule, and the congregation policed the boundaries. Our talents, creativity, strength, supernatural power, were impossible to ignore in mixed groups. It was as if the power of a witch highlighted the creative energy of any nearby demons, and the genius of a demon made a vampire's beauty more striking. As for our relationship with humans, we were supposed to keep a low profile and steer clear of politics and religion. Just this morning, Matthew had insisted there were too many other problems facing the congregation in the 16th century. Religious war, the burning of heretics, and the popular hunger for the strange and bizarre newly fed by the technology of the printing press, for its members to bother with something so trivial as a witch and a vampire who had fallen in love. Given the bewildering and dangerous events that had taken place since I'd met Matthew in late September, I had found this difficult to believe.
"Which congregation?" George asked with interest. "Is this some new religious sect?"
Walter ignored his friend's question and gave Matthew a piercing look. Then he turned to me.
"And do you still have this book?"
"No one has it. It went back into the library. The witches expect me to recall it for them."
"So you are hunted for two reasons. Some want to keep you from a werch, others see you as a necessary means to a desired end."
Walter pinched the bridge of his nose and looked at Matthew tiredly.
"You are a veritable lodestone when it comes to trouble, my friend. And this couldn't have happened at a more inopportune time. The Queen's anniversary celebration is less than 3 weeks away. You're expected at court."
"Never mind the Queen's celebration. We are not safe with a time spinner in our midst. She can see what fate has in store for each of us. The witch will be able to undo our futures, cause ill fortune, even hasten our deaths."
Kit rocketed out of his chair to stand before Matthew.
"How, by all that is holy, could you do this?"
"It seems your much-vaunted atheism has failed you, Kit," said Matthew evenly. "Afraid you might have to answer for your sins after all?"
"I may not believe in a beneficent, all-powerful deity as you do, Matthew, but there is more to this world than what's described in your philosophy books. And this woman, this witch, cannot be allowed to meddle in our affairs. You may be in her thrall, but I have no intention of putting my future in her hands," Kit retorted.
"A moment."
A look of growing astonishment passed over George's face.
"Did you come to us from Chester, Matthew, or..."
"No. You must not answer, Matt," Tom said with sudden lucidity. "Janus has come among us to work some purpose, and we must not interfere."
"Talk sense, Tom, if you can," Kit said nastily.
With one face, Matthew and Diana looked to the past. With the other, they consider the future, Tom said, unconcerned with Kit's interruption.
"But if Matt is not..."
George trailed off into silence.
"Tom is right," Walter said gruffly.
"Matthew is our friend and has asked for our help. It is, so far as I can recall, the first time he has done so. That is all we need to know."
"He asks too much," Kit retorted.
"Too much? It's little and late, in my opinion. Matthew paid for one of my ships, saved Henry's estates, and has long kept George and Tom in books and dreams. As for you..."
Walter surveyed Marlowe from head to toe.
Everything in you and on you, from your ideas to your last cup of wine to the hat on your head, is thanks to Matthew Royden's good graces. Providing a safe port for his wife during this present tempest is a trifle in comparison.
Thank you, Walter.
Matthew looked relieved, but the smile he turned on me was tentative. Winning over his friends, Walter in particular, had been more difficult than he'd anticipated.
We will need to devise a story to explain how your wife came to be here,
Walter said thoughtfully.
Something to divert attention from her strangeness.
Diana needs a teacher, too, added Matthew.
She must be taught some manners, certainly, Kit grumbled.
No, her teacher must be another witch, Matthew corrected him.
Walter made a low sound of amusement.
I doubt there's a witch within 20 miles of Woodstock, not with you living here.
And what of this book, Mistress Royden?
George whipped out a pointed grey stick wrapped in a string from a pocket hidden away in the bulbous outlines of his short breeches. He licked the tip of his pencil and held it expectantly.
Can you tell me its size and contents? I will look for it in Oxford.
The book can wait, I said. First, I need proper clothes. I can't go out of the house wearing Pierre's jacket and the skirt that Matthew's sister wore to Jane Seymour's funeral.
Go out of the house? Kit scoffed. Utter lunacy!
Kit is right, George said apologetically. He made a notation in his book. Your speech makes it apparent you are a stranger to England. I would be happy to give you elocution lessons, Mistress Royden.
The idea of George Chapman playing Henry Higgins to my Eliza Doolittle was enough to make me look longingly at the exit.
She shouldn't be allowed to speak at all, Matt. You must keep her quiet, Kit insisted.
What we need is a woman, someone to advise Diana. Why is there not one daughter, wife, or mistress to be had among the five of you? Matthew demanded.
Deep silence fell.
Walter?
Kit asked archly, sending the rest of the men into a fit of laughter and lightening the heavy atmosphere as though a summer storm had blown through the room. Even Matthew joined in. Pierre entered as the laughter faded, kicking up sprigs of rosemary and lavender strewn among the rushes laid down to keep dampness from being tromped through the house. At the same moment, the bells began to toll the hour of 12. Like the sight of the quinces, the combination of sounds and smells took me straight back to Madison. Past, present, and future met. Rather than a slow, fluid unspooling, there was a moment of stillness as if time had stopped. My breath hitched.
Diana, Matthew said, taking me by the elbows.
Something blue and amber, a weave of light and color, caught my attention. It was tightly meshed in the corner of the room, where nothing could fit but cobwebs and dust. Fascinated, I tried to move toward it.
Is she having a fit?
Henry asked, his face coming into focus over Matthew's shoulder. The tolling of the bell stopped, and the scent of lavender faded. Blue and amber flickered to gray and white before disappearing.
I'm sorry. I thought I saw something in the corner. It must have been a trick of the light, I said, pressing my hand to my cheek.
Perhaps you're suffering from time lag, mon coeur, Matthew murmured. I promised you a walk in the park. Will you go outside with me to clear your head?
Maybe it was the after-effects of time-walking, and perhaps fresh air would help. But we had just arrived, and Matthew hadn't seen these men for more than 4 centuries. You should be with your friends, I said firmly, though my eyes drifted to the windows.
They'll still be here, drinking my wine when we return, Matthew said with a smile.
He turned to Walter.
I'm going to show Diana her house and make sure she is able to find her way through the gardens.
We will need to talk further, Walter warned. There is business to discuss.
Matthew nodded and tucked his hand around my waist.
It can wait.
We left the school of night in the warm parlor and headed outdoors.
Tom had already lost interest in the problems of vampire and witch and was engrossed in his reading. George was similarly consumed by his own thoughts and busily writing in a notebook. Kit's glance was watchful. Walter's wary, and Henry's eyes were filled with sympathy. The three men looked like an unkindness of ravens with their dark clothes and attentive expressions. It reminded me of what Shakespeare would soon say about this extraordinary group. "How does it begin?" I murmured softly. "Black is the badge of hell?" Matthew looked wistful.
"Black is the badge of hell, the hue of dungeons and the school of night."
"The hue of friendship would be more accurate," I said. I'd seen Matthew manage the readers at the Bodleian, but his influence over the likes of Walter Raleigh and Kit Marlowe was still unexpected. "Is there anything they wouldn't do for you, Matthew?"
"Pray God we never find out," he said somberly.
Chapter 3. On Monday morning, I was tucked into Matthew's office. It was located between Pierre's apartments and a smaller chamber that was used for estate business, and it afforded a view toward the gatehouse and the Woodstock Road. Most of the lads, now that I knew them better, it seemed a far more fitting collective term than the grandiose school of night, were closeted in what Matthew called the breakfast room, drinking ale and wine and applying their considerable imaginations to my backstory. Walter assured me it would, when complete, explain my sudden appearance at Woodstock to curious residents and alleviate questions about my odd accent and ways. What they had concocted so far was melodramatic in the extreme. This was not surprising, given that our two resident playwrights, Kit and George, came up with the key elements of the plot. The characters included dead French parents, avaricious noblemen who had preyed on a helpless orphan, me, and aged lechers intent on stripping me of my virtue. The tale turned epic with my spiritual trials and conversion from Catholicism to Calvinism. These led to voluntary exile on England's Protestant shores, years of abject poverty, and Matthew's fortuitous rescue and instantaneous regard. George, who really was something of a schoolmarm, promised to drill me in the particulars when they had applied the finishing touches to the story. I was enjoying some quiet, which was a rare commodity in a crowded Elizabethan household of this size. Like a troublesome child, Kit unerringly gauged the worst moment to deliver the mail, announce dinner, or request Matthew's help with some problem. And Matthew was understandably eager to be with friends he had never expected to see again. At present, he was with Walter, and I was devoting my attention to a small book while awaiting his return. He'd left his table by the window littered with bags of sharpened quills and glass pots full of ink. Other tools were scattered nearby, a stick of wax to seal his correspondence, a thin knife to open letters, a candle, a silver shaker. This last was full not of salt but sand, as my gritty eggs this morning had proved. My table held a similar shaker to set the ink on the page and keep it from smudging. A single pot of black ink and the remains of three pens. I was currently destroying a fourth in an effort to master the complicated swirls of Elizabethan handwriting. Making a to-do list should have been a snap. As a historian, I had spent years reading old handwriting and knew exactly how the letters should look, what words were most common, and the erratic spelling choices that were mine to make in a time where there were few dictionaries and grammatical rules. It turned out that the challenge lay not in knowing what to do, but in actually doing it. After working for years to become an expert, I was a student again. Only this time my objective wasn't to understand the past, but to live in it. Thus far it had been a humbling experience, and all I'd managed was to make a mess of the first page of the pocket-sized blank book Matthew had given me this morning.
"It's the Elizabethan equivalent of a laptop computer," he'd explained, handing me the slim volume. "You're a woman of letters, and need somewhere to put them."
I cracked the tight binding, releasing the crisp smell of paper. Most virtuous women of the time used these little books for prayers. Diana. There was a thick blot where I'd pressed down at the beginning of the D, and by the time I reached the last A, the pen was out of ink. Still, my effort was a perfectly respectable example of the period's italic hand. My hand moved far more slowly than Matthew's did when he wrote letters using the squiggly secretary script. That was the handwriting of lawyers, doctors, and other professionals, but too difficult for me at present. Bishop. That was even better. But my smile quickly dissolved, and I struck out my last name. I was married now. I dipped the pen in the ink. De Clermont. Diana de Clermont. That made me sound like a countess, not a historian. A drop of ink fell wetly onto the page below. I stifled a curse at the black spot. Happily, it hadn't obliterated my name. But that wasn't my name either. I smudged the blob over de Clermont. You could still read it, barely. I steadied my hand and deliberately formed the correct letters. Royden. That was my name now. Diana Royden, wife of the most obscure figure associated with the mysterious School of Night. I examined the page critically. My handwriting was a disaster. It looked nothing like what I'd seen of the chemist Robert Boyle's neat, rounded script, or that of his brilliant sister Catherine. I hoped that women's handwriting in the 1590s was far messier than it was in the 1690s. A few more strokes of the pen and a final flourish, and I would be done. Her book. Male voices sounded outside. I put down my pen with a frown and went to the window. Matthew and Walter were below. The panes of glass muffled their words, but the subject of the conversation was evidently unpleasant, judging from Matthew's harried expression and the bristling line of Raleigh's eyebrows. When Matthew made a dismissive gesture and turned to walk away, Walter stopped him with a firm hand. Something had been bothering Matthew since he'd received the first batch of mail this morning. A stillness had come over him, and he'd held the pouch without opening it. Though he'd explained that the letters dealt with ordinary estate business, surely there was more there than demands for taxes and bills due. I pressed my warm palm against the cold pane, as if it were the only glass that stood between me and Matthew. The play of temperatures reminded me of the contrast between warm-blooded witch and cold-blooded vampire. I returned to my seat and picked up my pen.
You decided to make your mark on the 16th century after all.
Matthew was suddenly at my side. The twitch at the corner of his mouth indicated amusement, but didn't entirely disguise his tension. I'm still not sure that creating a lasting memento of my time here is a good idea, I confessed. A future scholar might realize there's something odd about it. Just as Kit had known there was something wrong with me.
Don't worry. The book won't leave the house.
Matthew reached for his stack of mail. You can't be sure of that, I protested.
Let history take care of itself, Diana, he said decisively, as if the matter were now closed.
But I couldn't let go of the future, or my worries about the effects that our presence in the past might have on it. I still don't think we should let Kit keep that chess piece. The memory of Marlowe triumphantly brandishing the tiny figure of Diana haunted me. She occupied the role of the White Queen in Matthew's costly silver chess set, and had been one of the objects I'd used to steer us to the proper place in the past. Two unfamiliar young demons, Sophie Norman and her husband Nathaniel Wilson, had unexpectedly delivered it to my aunt's house in Madison just as we were deciding to time walk.
Kit won it from me fair and square last night, just as he was supposed to do. At least this time I could see how he managed it. He distracted me with his rook.
Matthew dashed off a note with enviable speed before folding the pages into a neat packet. He dropped a molten blob of vermilion across the edges of the letter before pressing his signet ring into it. The golden surface of the ring bore the simple glyph for the planet Jupiter, not the more elaborate emblem that Satu had burned into my flesh. The wax crackled as it cooled.
Somehow my White Queen went from Kit to a family of witches in North Carolina. We have to believe that it will do so again, with or without our help.
Kit didn't know me before, and he doesn't like me.
All the more reason not to worry. As long as it pains him to look upon the likeness of Diana, he won't be able to part with it. Christopher Marlowe is a masochist of the First Order.
Matthew took up another letter and sliced it open with his knife. I surveyed the other items on my table and picked up a pile of coins. A working knowledge of Elizabethan currency had not been covered in my graduate education, nor had household management, the proper order of donning undergarments, forms of address for servants, or how to make a medicine for Tom's headache. Discussions with Francoise about my wardrobe revealed my ignorance of common names for ordinary colors. Goose turd green was familiar to me, but the peculiar shade of grizzled brown known as rat hair was not. My experiences thus far had me planning to throttle the first Tudor historian I met upon my return for gross dereliction of duty. But there was something compelling about figuring out the details of everyday life, and I quickly forgot my annoyance. I picked through the coins in my palm, looking for a silver penny. It was the cornerstone on which my precarious knowledge was built. The coin was no bigger than my thumbnail, as thin as a wafer, and bore the same profile of Queen Elizabeth as did most of the others. I organized the rest according to relative worth, and began an orderly account of them on the next clean page in my book.
"Thank you, Pierre," Matthew murmured, barely glancing up as his servant whisked away the sealed letters and deposited still more correspondence on the surface.
We wrote in companionable silence. Soon finished with my list of coins, I tried to remember what Charles, the household's laconic cook, had taught me about making a caudle. Or was it a posset? A caudle for pains in the head. Satisfied with the relatively straight line of text, three tiny blots and the wobbly C, I continued. Set your water to boil. Beat two egg yolks. Add white wine and beat some more. When the water boils, set it to cool, then add the wine and eggs. Stir it as it boils again, adding saffron and honey. The resulting mixture had been revolting, violently yellow with the consistency of runny cottage cheese, but Tom had slurped it down without complaint. Later, when I'd asked Charles for the proper proportion of honey to wine, he'd thrown up his hands in disgust at my ignorance and stalked away without a word. Living in the past had always been my secret desire, but it was far more difficult than I'd ever imagined. I sighed.
You'll need more than that book to feel at home here.
Matthew's eyes didn't leave his correspondence.
You should have a room of your own, too. Why don't you take this one? It's bright enough to serve as a library. Or you could turn it into an alchemical laboratory, although you might want somewhere more private if you're planning to turn lead into gold. There's a room by the kitchen that might do.
The kitchen may not be ideal. Charles doesn't approve of me, I replied.
He doesn't approve of anyone. Neither does Francoise. Except for Charles, of course, whom she venerates as a misunderstood saint, despite his fondness for drink.
Sturdy feet tromped down the hall. The disapproving Francoise appeared at the threshold.
"There are many for Mistress Royden," she announced, stepping aside to reveal a gray-haired septuagenarian with calloused hands and a much younger man who shifted from one foot to the other. Neither of these men was a creature.
"Summers?" Matthew frowned. "And is that young Joseph Bidwell?"
"Aye, Master Royden."
The younger man pulled his cap from his head.
"Mistress Royden will allow you to take her measurements now," Francoise said.
"Measurements?"
The look Matthew directed to me and Francoise demanded an answer, quickly.
"Shoes, gloves, for Madame's wardrobe," Francoise said.
Unlike petticoats, shoes were not one size fits most. "I asked Francoise to send for them," I explained, hoping to gain Matthew's cooperation. Summers' eyes widened at my strange accent before his face returned to an expression of neutral deference.
My wife's journey was unexpectedly difficult, Matthew said smoothly, coming to stand by my side. And her belongings were lost. Regrettably, Bidwell, we have no shoes for you to copy. He rested a warning hand on my shoulder, hoping to silence any further commentary.
May I, Mistress Royden?
Bidwell asked, lowering himself until his fingers hovered over the ties that secured a pair of ill-fitting shoes to my feet. The borrowed footwear was a giveaway that I wasn't who I was pretending to be.
Please, Matthew replied before I could respond.
Francoise gave me a sympathetic look. She knew what it was like to be silenced by Matthew Royden. The young man started when he came into contact with a warm foot and its frequent pulse. Clearly he expected a colder, less lively extremity.
About your business, Matthew said sharply.
Sir, my lord, Master Royden.
The young man blurted out most available titles except for Your Majesty and Prince of Darkness. These were implied, nonetheless.
Where's your father, lad?
Matthew's voice softened.
Sick abed these 4 days past, Master Royden.
Bidwell drew a piece of felt from a bag tied around his waist and placed each of my feet on it, tracing the outlines with a stick of charcoal. He made some notations on the felt and, quickly finished, released my foot. Bidwell pulled out a curious book made from squares of colored hide sewn together with leather thongs and offered it to me.
What colors are popular, Master Bidwell? I asked, waving the leather samples away.
I needed advice, not a multiple-choice test.
Ladies who are going to court are having white stamped with gold or silver.
We're not going to court, Matthew said swiftly.
Black, then, and a nice tawny.
Bidwell held up for approval a patch of leather the color of caramel. Matthew gave it before I could say a word. Then it was the older man's turn. He, too, was surprised when he took my hand and felt the calluses on my palms. Well-bred ladies who married men such as Matthew didn't row boats. Summers took in the lump on my middle finger. Ladies didn't have bumps from holding pens too tightly either. He slid a buttery soft glove that was much too large onto my right hand. A needle, charged with coarse thread, was tucked into the hem.
Does your father have everything he needs, Bidwell? Matthew asked the shoemaker.
Yes, thank you, Master Royden, Bidwell replied with a bob of his head.
Charles will send him custard and venison.
Matthew's gray eyes flickered over the young man's thin frame. Some wine, too.
Master Bidwell will be grateful for your kindness, Summers said, his fingers drawing the thread through the leather so that the glove fit snugly.
Is anyone else ill? Matthew asked.
Ralph Meadows' girl was sick with a terrible fever. We feared for old Edward, but he is only afflicted with an ague, Summers replied tersely.
I trust Meadows' daughter has recovered.
No.
Summers snapped the thread.
They buried her 3 days ago, God rest her soul.
Amen, said everyone in the room. Francoise lifted her eyebrows and jerked her head in Summers' direction. Belatedly, I joined in. Their business concluded, and the shoes and gloves promised for later in the week, both men bowed and departed. Francoise turned to follow them out, but Matthew stopped her.
No more appointments for Diana.
There was no mistaking the seriousness in his tone.
See to it that Edward Campbell has a nurse to look after him and sufficient food and drink.
Francoise curtsied in acquiescence and departed with another sympathetic glance. I'm afraid the men from the village know I don't belong here. I drew a shaking hand across my forehead. My vowels are a problem, and my sentences go down when they should go up. When are you supposed to say amen? Somebody needs to teach me how to pray, Matthew. I have to start somewhere, and—
Slow down, he said, sliding his hands around my corseted waist. Even through several layers of clothing, his touch was soothing. This isn't an Oxford viva, nor are you making your stage debut. Cramming information and rehearsing your lines isn't going to help. You should have asked me before you summoned Bidwell and Summers.
How can you pretend to be someone new, someone else, over and over again?
I wondered. Matthew had done this countless times over the centuries, as he pretended to die only to reemerge in a different country, speaking a different language, known by a different name.
The first trick is to stop pretending. My confusion must have been evident, and he continued. Remember what I told you in Oxford? You can't live a lie, whether it's masquerading as a human when you're really a witch, or trying to pass as an Elizabethan when you're from the 21st century. This is your life for now. Try not to think of it as a role.
But my accent, the way that I walk? Even I had noticed the length of my steps relative to that of the other women in the house, but Kit's open mockery of my masculine stride had brought the point home.
You'll adjust. Meanwhile, people will talk, but no one's opinion in Woodstock matters. Soon you'll be familiar and the gossip will stop. I looked at him doubtfully. You don't know much about gossip, do you? Enough to know you are simply this week's curiosity.
He glanced at my book, taking in the blotches and indecisive script.
You're holding your pen too tightly. That's why the point keeps breaking and the ink won't flow. You're holding on to your new life too tightly as well.
I never thought it would be so difficult.
You're a fast learner, and so long as you're safely at the old lodge, you're among friends. But no more visitors for the time being. Now, what have you been writing?
My name, mostly. Matthew flipped a few pages in my book, examining what I'd recorded.
One eyebrow lifted. You've been preparing for your economics and culinary examinations, too. Why don't you write about what's happening here at the house instead?
Because I need to know how to manage in the 16th century. Of course, a diary might be useful, too. I considered the possibility. It would certainly help me sort out my still-muddled sense of time. I shouldn't use full names. People in 1590 use initials to save paper and ink. And nobody reflects on thoughts or emotions. They record the weather and the phases of the moon.
Top marks on 16th century English record-keeping, said Matthew with a laugh.
Do women write down the same things as men?
He took my chin in his fingers. You're impossible. Stop worrying about what other women do. Be your own extraordinary self.
When I nodded, he kissed me before returning to his table. Holding the pen as loosely as possible, I began a fresh page. I decided to use astrological symbols for the days of the week and record the weather as well as a few cryptic notes about life at the old lodge. That way, no one reading them in a future time would find anything out of the ordinary. Or so I hoped. Saturn. 31 October, 1590. Rain. Clearing. On this day, I was introduced to my husband's good friend, C.M. Sun, 1 November, 1590. Cold and dry. In the early hours of the morning, I made the acquaintance of G.C. After sunrise, T.H., H.P., W.R. arrived, all friends of my husband. The moon was full. Some future scholar might suspect that these initials referred to the School of Night, especially given the name Royden on the first page, but there would be no way to prove it. Besides, these days few scholars were interested in this group of intellectuals. Educated in the finest Renaissance style, the members of the School of Night were able to move between ancient and modern languages with alarming speed. All of them knew Aristotle backward and forward, and when Kit, Walter, and Matthew began talking politics, their encyclopedic command of history and geography made it nearly impossible for anyone else to keep up. Occasionally, George and Tom managed to squeak in an opinion, but Henry's stammer and slight deafness made his full participation in the intricate discussions impossible. He spent most of the time quietly observing the others with a shy deference that was endearing, considering that the Earl outranked everyone in the room. If there weren't so many of them, I might be able to keep up, too. As for Matthew, Gone was the thoughtful scientist brooding over his test results and worrying about the future of the species. I'd fallen in love with that Matthew, but found myself doing so all over again with this 16th century version, charmed by every peal of his laughter and each quick rejoinder he made when battles broke out over some fine point of philosophy. Matthew shared jokes over dinner and hummed songs in the corridors. He wrestled with his dogs by the fire in the bedroom, two enormous shaggy mastiffs named Anaximander and Pericles. In modern Oxford or France, Matthew had always seemed slightly sad. But he was happy here in Woodstock, even when I caught him looking at his friends as though he couldn't quite believe they were real. "Did you realize how much you missed them?" I asked, unable to refrain from interrupting his work.
"Vampires can't brood over those we leave behind," he replied. "We'd go mad. I have had more to remember them by than is usually the case, their words, their portraits. You forget the little things, though. A quirk of expression, the sound of their laughter."
"My father kept caramels in his pocket," I whispered. "I had no memory of them until LaPierre." When I shut my eyes, I could still smell the tiny candies and hear the rustle of the cellophane against the soft broadcloth of his shirts.
"And you wouldn't give up that knowledge now," Matthew said gently, "not even to be rid of the pain."
He took up another letter, his pen scratching against the page. The tight look of concentration returned to his face, along with a small crease over the bridge of his nose. I imitated the angle at which he held the quill, the length of time that elapsed before he dipped it in the ink. It was indeed easier to write when you didn't hold the pen in a death grip. I poised the pen over the paper and prepared to write more. "Today was the Feast of All Souls, the traditional day to remember the dead. Everyone in the house was remarking upon the thick frost that iced the leaves in the garden. Tomorrow would be even colder," Pierre promised. Moon. 2 November, 1590. Frost. Measured for shoes and gloves. Francoise sewing. Francoise was making me a cloak to keep the chill away and a warm suit of clothes for the wintry weather ahead. She had been in the attics all morning, sorting through Louisa de Clermont's abandoned wardrobe. Matthew's sister's gowns were 60 years out of date, with their square necklines and bell-shaped sleeves, but Francoise was altering them to better fit what Walter and George insisted was the current style, as well as my less statuesque frame. She wasn't pleased to be ripping apart the seams of one particularly splendid black and silver garment, but Matthew had insisted. With the School of Night in residence, I needed formal clothes as well as more practical outfits.
"But Lady Louisa was wed in that gown, my lord," Francoise protested.
"Yes, to an 85-year-old with no living offspring, a bad heart, and numerous profitable estates. I believe the thing has more than repaid the family's investment in it," Matthew replied. "It will do for Diana until you can make her something better." My book couldn't refer to that conversation, of course. Instead, I'd chosen all my words carefully, so that they would mean nothing to anyone else, even though they conjured vivid images of particular people, sounds, and conversations for me. If this book survived, a future reader would find these tiny snippets of my life sterile and dry. Historians pored over documents like this, hoping in vain to see the rich, complex life hidden behind the simple lines of text. Matthew swore under his breath. I was not the only one in this house hiding something. "My husband received many letters today and gave me this book to keep my memories." As I lifted my pen to replenish its ink, Henry and Tom entered the room, looking for Matthew. My third eye blinked open, surprising me with sudden awareness. Since we had arrived, my other nascent powers—which fire, which water, and which wind—had been oddly absent. With the unexpected extra perception offered by my witch's third eye, I could discern not only the black-red intensity of the atmosphere around Matthew, but also Tom's silvery light
and Henry's barely perceptible green-black shimmer, each as individual as a fingerprint. Thinking back on the threads of blue and amber that I'd seen in the corner of the old lodge, I wondered what the disappearance of some powers and the emergence of others might signify. There had been the episode this morning, too. Something in the corner had caught my eye. Another glimmer of amber shot through with hints of blue. There was an echo, something so quiet it was more felt than heard. When I'd turned my head to locate its source, the sensation faded. Strands pulsed in my peripheral vision, as if time were beckoning me to return home. Ever since my first time walk in Madison, when I'd traveled a brief span of minutes, I'd thought of time as a substance made of threads of light and color. With enough concentration, you could focus on a single thread and follow it to its source. Now, after walking through several centuries, I knew that apparent simplicity masked the knots of possibility that tied an unimaginable number of pasts to a million presents and untold potential futures. Isaac Newton had believed that time was an essential force of nature that couldn't be controlled. After fighting our way back to 1590, I was prepared to agree with him. "Diana, are you all right?" Matthew's insistent voice broke through my reveries. His friends looked at me with concern. "Fine," I said automatically. "You're not fine." He tossed the quill onto the table. "Your scent has changed. I think your magic might be changing too. Kit is right. We must find you a witch as quickly as possible." "It's too soon to bring in a witch," I protested. "It's important that I be able to look and sound as if I belong." "Another witch will know you're a time walker," he said dismissively. "She'll make allowances. Or is there something else?" I shook my head, unwilling to meet his eyes. Matthew hadn't needed to see time unwinding in the corner to sense that something was out of joint. If he already suspected that there was more going on with my magic than I was willing to reveal, there would be no way for me to conceal my secrets from any witch who might soon come to call. Chapter 4. The School of Night had been eager to help Matthew find the creature. Their suggestions illuminated a collective disregard for women, witches, and everyone who lacked a university education. Henry thought London might provide the most fertile ground for the search, but Walter assured him that it would be impossible to conceal me from superstitious neighbors in the crowded city. George wondered if the scholars of Oxford might be persuaded to lend their expertise, since they, at least, had proper intellectual credentials. Tom and Matthew gave a brutal critique of the strengths and weaknesses of the natural philosophers in residence, and that idea was cast aside, too. Kit didn't believe it was wise to trust any woman with the task, and drew up a list of local gentlemen who might be willing to establish a training regimen for me. It included the parson of St. Mary's, who was alert to apocalyptic signs in the heavens, a nearby landowner named Smithson, who dabbled in alchemy and had been looking for a witch or demon to assist him, and a student at Christ Church College who paid his overdue book bills by casting horoscopes. Matthew vetoed all these suggestions and called on Widow Beaton, Woodstock's cunning woman and midwife. She was poor and female, precisely the sort of creature the School of Night scorned, but this, Matthew argued, would better ensure her cooperation. Besides, Widow Beaton was the only creature for miles with purported magical talents. All others had long since fled, he admitted, rather than live near a wech. "Summoning Widow Beaton might not be a good idea," I said later when we were getting ready for bed. "So you've mentioned," Matthew replied, with barely concealed impatience. "But if Widow Beaton can't help us, she'll be able to recommend someone who can." "The late 16th century really isn't a good time to openly ask around for a witch, Matthew." I'd been able to do little more than hint at the prospect of witch hunts when we were with the School of Night, but Matthew knew the horrors to come. Once again, he dismissed my concern. "The Chelmsford witch trials are only memories now, and it will be another 20 years before the Lancashire hunts begin."
I wouldn't have brought you here if a witch hunt were about to break out in England.
Matthew picked through a few letters that Pierre had left for him on the table.
With reasoning like that, it's a good thing you're a scientist and not a historian, I said bluntly. Chelmsford and Lancashire were extreme outbursts of far more widespread concerns.
You think a historian can understand the tenor of the present moment better than the men living through it?
Matthew's eyebrow cocked up in open skepticism.
Yes, I said, bristling. We often do.
That's not what you said this morning, when you couldn't figure out why there weren't any forks in the house, he observed.
It was true that I'd searched high and low for 20 minutes before Pierre gently broke it to me that the utensils were not yet common in England.
Surely you aren't one of those people who believe that historians do nothing but memorize dates and learn obscure facts, I said. My job is to understand why things happened in the past.
When something occurs right in front of you, it's hard to see the reasons for it, but hindsight provides a clearer perspective.
Then you can relax, because I have both experience and hindsight, Matthew said. I understand your reservations, Diana, but calling on Widow Beaton is the right decision.
Case closed, his tone made clear.
In the 1590s, there are food shortages, and people are worried about the future, I said, ticking the items off on my fingers. That means people are looking for scapegoats to take the blame for the bad times. Already, human-cunning women and midwives fear being accused of witchcraft, though your male friends may not be aware of it.
I am the most powerful man in Woodstock, Matthew said, taking me by the shoulders. No one will accuse you of anything.
I was amazed at his hubris.
I'm a stranger, and Widow Beaton owes me nothing.
If I draw curious eyes, I pose a serious threat to her safety, I retorted. At the very least, I need to pass as an upper-class Elizabethan woman before we ask her for help. Give me a few more weeks.
This can't wait, Diana, he said brusquely.
I'm not asking you to be patient so I can learn how to embroider samplers and make jam. There are good reasons for it.
I looked at him sourly.
Call in your cunning woman, but don't be surprised when this goes badly.
Trust me. Matthew lowered his lips toward mine. His eyes were smoky and his instincts to pursue his prey and push it into submission were sharp. Not only did the 16th century husband want to prevail over his wife, but the vampire wanted to capture the witch.
I don't find arguments the slightest bit arousing, I said, turning my head.
Matthew clearly did, however. I moved a few inches away from him.
I'm not arguing, Matthew said softly, his mouth close to my ear. You are. And if you think I would ever touch you in anger, wife, you are very much mistaken.
After pinning me to the bedpost with frosty eyes, he turned and snatched up his breeches.
I'm going downstairs. Someone will still be awake to keep me company.
He stalked toward the door. Once he reached it, he paused.
And if you really want to behave like an Elizabethan woman, stop questioning me, he said roughly as he departed.
The next day, one vampire, two demons, and three humans examined my appearance in silence across the wide floorboards. The bells of St. Mary's Church sounded the hour, faint echoes of their music lingering long after the peals ceased. Quince, rosemary, and lavender scented the air. I was perched on an uncomfortable wooden chair in a confining array of smocks, petticoats, sleeves, skirts, and a tightly laced bodice. My career-oriented 21st-century life faded further with each restricted breath. I stared out into the murky daylight, where cold rain pinged against the panes of glass in the leaded windows.
Elle est ici, Pierre announced, his glance flicking in my direction. The witch is here to see Madame.
At last, Matthew said.
The severe lines of his doublet made him look even broader through the shoulders, while the acorns and oak leaves, stitched in black around the edges of his white collar, accentuated the paleness of his skin. He angled his dark head to gain a fresh perspective on whether I passed muster as a respectable Elizabethan wife.
Well, he demanded, will that do?
George lowered his spectacles.
Yes, the russet of this gown suits her far better than the last one did and gives a pleasant cast to her hair.
Mistress Royden looks the part, George, it is true. But we cannot explain away her unusual speech simply by saying that she comes from the country,
Henry said in his toneless bass. He stepped forward to twitch the folds of my brocade skirt into place.
And her height, there is no disguising that. She is taller even than the Queen.
Are you sure we can't pass her off as French, Schwartz, or Dutch?
Tom lifted a clove-studded orange to his nose with ink-stained fingers. Perhaps Mistress Royden could survive in London after all. Demons cannot fail to notice her, of course, but ordinary men may not give her a second glance.
Walter snorted with amusement and unspooled from a low settle.
Mistress Royden is finely shaped, as well as uncommon tall. Ordinary men between the ages of 13 and 60 will find reason enough to study her.
No, Tom, she's better off here with Widow Beaton.
Perhaps I could meet Widow Beaton later in the village alone, I suggested, hoping that one of them might see sense and persuade Matthew to let me do this my way.
No, cried out 6 horrified male voices.
Francoise appeared, bearing 2 pieces of starched linen and lace, her bosom swelling like that of an indignant hen facing down a pugnacious rooster. She was as annoyed by Matthew's constant interference as I was.
"Diana's not going to court. That ruff is unnecessary," said Matthew with an impatient gesture. "Besides, it's her hair that's a problem."
"You have no idea what's necessary," Francoise retorted.
Though she was a vampire and I was a witch, we had reached unexpected common ground when it came to the idiocy of men.
"Which would Madame de Clermont prefer?"
She extended a pleated nest of gauzy fabric and something crescent-shaped that resembled snowflakes joined together with invisible stitches. The snowflakes looked more comfortable. I pointed to them. While Francoise affixed the collar to the edge of my bodice, Matthew reached up in another attempt to put my hair in a more pleasing arrangement. Francoise slapped his hand away.
"Don't touch!"
"I'll touch my wife when I like. And stop calling Diana Madame de Clermont," Matthew rumbled, moving his hands to my shoulders. "I keep expecting my mother to walk through the door."
He drew the edges of the collar apart, pulling loose the black velvet cord that hid Francoise's pins.
"Madame is a married woman. A bosom should be covered. There is enough gossip about the new mistress," Francoise protested.
"Gossip? What kind of gossip?" I asked with a frown.
"You were not in church yesterday, so there is talk that you are with child or afflicted by smallpox. That heretic priest believes you are Catholic. Others say you are Spanish."
"Spanish?"
"Oui, madame. Someone heard you in the stables yesterday afternoon."
"But I was practicing my French." I was a fair mimic and thought that imitating Isabeau's imperious accent might lend credence to my elaborate cover story.
"The groom's son did not recognize it as such."
Francoise's tone suggested that the boy's confusion was warranted. She studied me with satisfaction.
"Yes, you look like a respectable woman."
"Fallace sunt rerum species," said Kit, with a touch of acid that brought the scowl back to Matthew's face. "Appearances can be deceiving. No one will be taken in by her performance." "It's far too early in the day for Seneca."
Walter gave Marlowe a warning look.
"It is never too early for stoicism," Kit replied severely. "You should thank me it's not Homer. All we've heard lately is inept paraphrases of the Iliad. Leave the Greek to someone who understands it, George, someone like Matt."
"My translation of Homer's work is not yet finished," George retorted, bristling.
His response released a flood of Latin quotations from Walter. One of them made Matthew chuckle, and he said something in what I suspected was Greek. The witch waiting downstairs completely forgotten, the men enthusiastically engaged in their favorite pastime, verbal one-upmanship. I sank back into my chair.
"When they are in a fine humor like this, they are a wonder," Henry whispered. "These are the keenest wits in the kingdom, Mistress Royden."
Raleigh and Marlowe were now shouting at each other about the merits, or lack thereof, of Her Majesty.